This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a new study focuses on how the deck is stacked against Black women and girls. The election of a liberal mayor hasn't changed police behavior one bit in New York City. And where do Blacks in the U.S. stand in the fight against Israeli apartheid? But first, a grand jury in Greene County, Ohio, failed to indict the policeman who killed 22-year-old John Crawford III at a Walmart in August. Crawford was talking on his cell phone and handling one of the store's toy air rifles when the cops shot him down. Jovan Webster is a youth organizer with the Ohio Student Association, which mobilized to bring the U.S. Justice Department into the case. Webster says he never expected that the county prosecutor would fight for an indictment.
The indictment really left a lot of shock, confusion, anger, of course. I mean, for people in and out of the area, surrounding areas, and actually it was like a national shockwave. You know, there was a lot of people and a lot of magazines already posting, you know, how this was a blatant injustice that was basically justified. So when I saw it, when it came down, and I guess the prosecutor, the hand-picked prosecutor, said that there would be no indictment, and I mean, I just sat back on the couch and I said, well, go figure.
There's an old saying that a prosecutor who wants to can get a ham sandwich indicted. This one didn't get an indictment.
Exactly. I've never heard that. That's hilarious. So when he did that, you know, I wasn't surprised. I just got really calculated. I got really quiet, but my mind started to get real calculated throughout that day. Like, okay, well, how are we going to initiate Plan B? Our initial plan was actually granted to actually have the Department of Justice get involved. That was just a component of our Plan B. That was one of the biggest things that we needed to do to make sure that, you know, our Plan B was initiated was, okay, well, since Greene County and the surrounding areas aren't going to hand down justice like they should, we want to make sure that the big guys can do it. And they answered. You know, they were monitoring it just to make sure to see what they could do and if they could carry it out. And obviously they couldn't. So they're like, okay, we're stepping in. And we appreciate that. So we're going to keep our eyes on that.
History seems to tell us that if people on the ground don't do anything, those big guys you talk about in Washington won't either.
Yeah, I feel a little more eased about the fact that you would have somebody else look at it. But again, what you said about history telling us that the ground guys pretty much the same consensus with the big guys, that is a little unsettling. But I mean, right now we really have to, you know, use all the options that we have available. I think that the video in this case, it's way more heavier because this is actual evidence that you just see a blatant killing. I mean, you can watch it for yourself.
Yes, we did watch it, and we saw the victim, John Crawford, casually speaking on the phone, not acting in any kind of hostile manner, unless you think that young Black men are hostile inherently.
That's it. Here's the thing. Me holding a candy bar is threatening in America. It's almost like just the image alone can pose a threat. That right there is unsettling for me because, you know, I'm a direct reflection of John Crawford. I was around the same age. I mean, same skin color, same culture. So it's unsettling for me to know that, you know, the general society looks upon me, no matter if I have a long stick or an apple or a candy bar in my hand, it's like, oh, yeah, he's dangerous. I mean, because it's something that I don't understand. It's a cultural disconnect. I mean, there's definitely a cultural disconnect. And I found out that, you know, in humanity, you know, far too long, what people don't understand, they dismiss. And then they just try to basically highlight it as evil or negative. But just because you don't understand it doesn't mean it's evil or negative. It just means you don't understand it. But you have to take the time to learn it. But the question is, on top of that, do you think they want to take the time to learn? I don't think they do. So the problem just perpetuates, and it's like a cycle.
There are three young people's organizations involved here, and Xenia, Ohio, where you live, has a significant Black population. So what are the plans?
We held a community meeting in Dayton, Ohio, and in Columbus simultaneously, where we had a multicultural, a mixed race that came to one where we showed them the video in these groups. Then we broke up into like four or five different groups to where we started talking about actual tangible ideas and strategies that we can do that we can initiate like today and tomorrow. With social media being on our side and this being a high-tech society nowadays and the youth actually bringing in some type of new flavor to this freedom fighting, that can we can use those vehicles to promote what we're doing a lot quicker. You know, back when you had, you know, Martin Luther King and Malcolm's days, they didn't have that kind of technology. We have the technology, and I think that's another thing where the system kind of messed up. They messed up by giving us computers because kids are smart. Like, we're little techie kids, little 7-year-old or a 6-year-old knows how to use a cell phone better than a 20-year-old. So by giving us technology, you've also empowered us for things and movements like this. So we're definitely using social media. We're, you know, creating hashtags on Twitter and Facebook, and we have petitions, and we're going to call for re-indictment. And, you know, we got a couple of plans in the wing that we're definitely going to flex. So we're still calculating everything. But in the next coming weeks, we got a couple of plans that we're going to actually initiate, you know, public demonstrations. So stay tuned, because we're definitely not done yet. We don't give up that easy. Even though the Department of Justice has jumped in, we're still going to do what we have to do on the ground level.
Jovan Webster of the Ohio Student Association. Lots of folks had very high hopes for a change in police behavior in New York City when Bill de Blasio took over the mayor's office from Michael Bloomberg. But newly released figures show that nothing has changed under de Blasio in terms of arrests of people of color on petty, so-called quality of life charges. Robert Ganji, executive director of the Police Reform Organizing Project, says Mayor de Blasio and his police commissioner, Bill Bratton, are arresting just as many black and brown people as Mayor Bloomberg and his top cop, Raymond Kelly.
The statistics for felony arrests and misdemeanor arrests are remarkably similar between the 2 years. So we put out those statistics that we got from a state agency that compiles them. And we made the point that despite de Blasio's criticisms of the policing practices under Bloomberg and Kelly, and despite his promises to enact significant changes, the current NYPD is continuing the same harsh, aggressive, broken windows type of policing that characterized the Bloomberg-Kelly years. The target continues to be low-income people of color in terms of the vast, vast majority of people get arrested or get ticketed. And the focus also continues to be on low-level infractions rather than serious violent felonies.
One of the numbers that stands out in terms of New York being a marijuana decriminalized state is that in 2014, the same essential percentage of people of color were arrested for marijuana as in 2013. In 2013, 90.1% of those arrested for marijuana were people of color, and in 2014, 90.0%.
That's exactly right. And in both years, for the first 7 months of each year, there were over 20,000 marijuana misdemeanor arrests. So people should not in any way come under the illusion that the possession of marijuana or the smoking of small amounts of marijuana has been decriminalized in New York City, especially for black and brown people. All the research shows that the majority of people who use marijuana and smoke marijuana are white people, but in New York City, about 90% of the people who get arrested for the possession of marijuana are people of color. And that's a striking statistic that reflects an undeniable racial bias in the way the NYPD conducts its everyday practices.
Yes, because people in the street say unanimously that white kids are smoking marijuana with impunity on the streets.
Right. That appears to be the case based on the numbers that show up for misdemeanor marijuana arrests in New York City. And these are the police department's own statistics. We get them from a state agency, but the state agency gets them from the local police departments all across New York State. So we are only reporting on the practice of the NYPD is engaged in. We're doing it with the purpose of driving home what is an ugly truth, that every day, in effect, the NYPD engages in practices that inflict harm and hardship on particular groups of people, primarily low-income people of color. It's a practice marked by a stark racial bias. It represents policing that is wasteful, that distracts police resources from the pursuit of more serious offenses that the public is more truly concerned about than the possession of a marijuana cigarette. So we think that these policies are wrong and wrongheaded.
One could also make the inference that no commands have come down from Police Commissioner Bratton that affect the behavior of the troops, the police officers on the ground.
Well, I think based on the statistics, you can make that inference. It could also be that Bratton is proceeding very slowly, or that he hasn't been sufficiently forceful in his leadership. Whatever the reason for these numbers and for the discouraging results, particularly for many people who had hopes that the de Blasio-Bratton administration would begin to pursue a different kind of law enforcement strategy, would implement a different kind of policing in New York City, the practices on the ground remain very similar to the kind of practices that the city engaged in for the last several decades.
That was Robert Ganji of the Police Reform Organizing Project. There's a new report out from the National Women's Law Center and the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund on bias against black women and girls, especially in employment, education, and the criminal justice system. We spoke with one of the authors of the study, Fatima Goss Graves. She says more attention needs to be paid to injustice against black females.
Unfortunately, sometimes the ongoing barriers that we address in the report haven't gotten a lot of attention around what African American girls are facing. So we begin the report with a real review on some of the systemic challenges that they're facing, and some of these are things that boys and girls are facing together in schools, which makes sense because they're in the same schools. So whether that is lack of quality resources, not having the same access to credentialed teachers, not having the same access to rigorous course offerings, that sort of thing. But then we took a deep look at some of the specific challenges that African American girls face that are different from other population. We looked at the ways in which they experience overly punitive disciplinary practices. And that is a story that's gotten a lot of attention generally, but not so much in terms of the ways in which African American girls are sometimes punished unfairly. We're startled to know that the discipline rate for African American girls in school, suspension in school, is around 12%, which is a rate that is far higher than any other group of girl and higher than most groups of boys. We also looked at things like harassment and violence and trauma that goes unaddressed and its relationship to discipline. We looked at the barriers that African American girls who are pregnant or parenting encounter. And we looked at access to opportunities, whether it be course offerings that are rigorous like STEM, science and math programs, or extracurricular and athletic opportunities, the types of things that help students stay connected in school and can lead to lifelong additional opportunities.
When we speak, for example, about unemployment, lots of attention is paid, and righteously so, to the horrific unemployment rates among black men. But black female unemployment affects actually directly a lot more people because so many folks are dependent upon the female head of household.
Well, one of the things that has probably gotten too little attention is that the rates of unemployment for African American women are really high. And of every group over the last group, they're the only group that didn't have jobs gains. So those sorts of facts are really troubling. But we also spend a lot of time in the report talking about the ways in which concentration in low-wage jobs or not having a job at all impacts not only African American women, but their families and really entire communities. I actually think that part of the challenge with the unemployment rate for black women is that it has gone really unnoticed. I think that there is a sense that the economy generally is on the right track, a better track, and we've been watching jobs being added. One of the things, though, that we have been paying close attention to at the National Women's Law Center is both who is benefiting from those new jobs and where people are working. So I actually think that until you take a look back, it may be that people generally miss this really important point. What we learned is that unemployment for all women is actually has been declining from over 6% to 5.7%. But for African American women, they hadn't experienced the same sort of decline. So I think that what's happening now is that this story is just sort of beginning to be told. So now we know that over 10% of African American women are unemployed, and that's where they were a year ago. So although we have been making progress with other populations, we haven't been making progress here. So what that tells me is that there are a couple of things that could happen. You could be thinking about where you're concentrating resources in terms of increased job opportunities. You could be thinking about who is gaining what types of jobs. There's lots of sectors that have been gaining jobs where women haven't been gaining in those particular sectors, and that's another area that can be looked at.
And if, as you say, the story isn't being told, then not only does the state not respond, but philanthropies don't respond either.
You know, in our report that looks at African-American girls in school, we quite purposefully put out very specific action items for philanthropy, for their investment in these issues, in studying the issues, investing in community groups that support African-American women and girls, investing in research, investing in advocacy. You know, this is an area that really needs to be at the top of the agenda.
And finally, in terms of violence, we all know the terrible statistics in terms of mortality of young black men, but not much attention is paid to young black female victims of violence and perpetrators.
You know, I think the information that we've put together on around violence is really stunning, around rates of assault, around rates, the ways in which they experience violence or injury with a weapon. They face the highest rates of threatened violence or injury with a weapon than other girls. They're disproportionately vulnerable to child sex trafficking. They have high rates of sexual assault and dating violence. You know, all of these are things that exacerbate the outcomes for girls who don't receive counseling. And one of the things that we documented is that even girls who do try to get assistance, that they aren't always met with the appropriate responses from teachers and administrators in their school. So, you know, this is an issue that we think is especially important. It's absolutely tied to the issues around discipline and one that we hope gets more attention.
Fatima Goss-Graves of the National Women's Law Center. On October 11th, Mumia Abu-Jamal, Rebel Diaz, and a host of others will lend their voices to a rally to support the struggle for self-determination for the Palestinian people. The World Stands with Palestine rally will be held at the Malcolm X and Betty Shabazz Center in Harlem, formerly known as the Audubon Ballroom. Dr. Robin Spencer is one of the organizers. She's a professor of history at Lehman College in New York and an expert on the Black Panther Party and the Black Freedom Movement of the 60s. Especially among the black political class, it's rare nowadays to find people willing to stand in solidarity with Palestinians. But Professor Spencer says that is changing.
Definitely. I feel that there has been a transformation of late, especially with the recent attacks on Gaza and the ways in which that many activists have connected that to Ferguson, especially across the bounds of social media. So I feel that young people are leading the way in making those very important connections between the brutalities at home and the brutalities abroad and how they're connected to larger systematic issues around justice and self-determination for people of color. Now, I have to say, I do have a Tumblr, a blog, which is dedicated to highlighting moments of solidarity. And before, maybe 6 or 8 months ago, it was hard. I was really finding more historic examples of people like Huey Newton, of organizations in the past who made those connections. I feel that the reality is that the level of repression that has come down on political leaders who have dared to align themselves with the ideal of Palestinian humanity, self-determination, and freedom, the stakes for that have been incredibly high. And not to say that they weren't always very high, but I feel like the political courage, the radical analysis, the mass support for that sort of intellectual intervention just has not been there. So I'm excited this is a movement-building moment where young people can lead the way in making these very important connections that need to be made.
Because of Ferguson, the light was shown on the Pentagon's transfers of arms to police forces all across the country, just as the Pentagon transfers billions of dollars in arms every year to the Israelis.
Yes, I definitely feel those connections are there, and especially in the movements for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel, making those connections between the corporations who profit from oppression and how that's a global system, including even the wall built between the U.S. and Mexico, for example, connecting that to Palestine, to larger issues of racial oppression. I mean, I think it's very, very, the case can really be made strongly. And I feel like the actual impact of the corporation and the tangible evidence of that, the bullets, the tear gas made in one place, the canisters showed up in another place. I mean, it's very, very real.
And the very obvious connection, besides the violence inflicted on both peoples, is the fact that both peoples are struggling or have a history of struggling for self-determination, which is denied them.
Yes, definitely. And I think there's so many parallels. I think even beyond the recent attacks on Gaza, but just the reality of occupation, the economic underdevelopment of the Palestinian territories, the ways in which the daily life is militarized, the checkpoints, the role of the police and the military, the cultural appropriation and imperialism, and the very basic land grabs. I think the parallels are really, really strong, and I'm really excited to be part of an event whose goal is to make those connections. We're located in a historic center, you know, a neighborhood and community of people of color. So it's going to be an exciting event.
We here in the United States live in a place where there remain vestiges of apartheid, and in Israel, there is a growing system of apartheid.
Yes, definitely. I mean, when I traveled to the West Bank in January, I saw roads where your license plate determined your access to them. I was questioned by military officers armed with overkill and violence and racism, questioning you and really terrorizing you even with their presence or trying to terrorize you just to try to go from point A to point B. And I think the control of movement is very, very central. And again, the economic underdevelopment and the control of resources, just the quest for water in the occupied territories is huge. The fact that people are stuck in this kind of colonial relationship to their ability to gain access to natural resources. It's almost incomprehensible, but it's familiar. It's very familiar to those of us. I mean, there was a lot of solidarity between the Detroit water struggle and what was going on in the occupied territories as well. So there's real sort of material connections, I think, that are there.
And yet another connection. In Philadelphia in 1985, the police bombed the house where men, women, and children of the MOVE organization were staying and killed not only many of them, but also burned the entire block down, an incident that figures very heavily in the history of Mumia Abu-Jamal, who will also be a speaker at the October 11th event.
Yes, and we're also going to have Bassem Hamidi. He was tortured to paralysis. He has been detained without charges. We'll be hearing from someone who's going to speak to us about Palestinians of African descent to remind us about being cognizant of anti-blackness and how it operates even within liberation movements. We're going to have lots of women speaking to the conditions, the realities on the ground, just to make sure that we're not just supporting the struggle, but we're supporting the struggle within the struggle, because that's what real liberation is going to look like. And I think that the questions around solidarity and liberation are so important right now, when our communities are increasingly, the noose is tightening. At the same time, opportunity is there. So it's really an exciting moment. This is a movement that speaks to people of African descent. There are key entry points and there are concrete things to do. This is not just about an intellectual discussion or an intellectual connection. This is about joining organizations that are fighting against police brutality and against militarism. This is about coordinating boycotts for corporations that are having impact on all around the globe. So there's actually concrete things that we can do. And I think that is the outcome of the event. We're going to have a follow-up event that's going to coordinate people writing letters in support of Palestinian detainees and political prisoners. And I think that connecting the political prisoner struggle, connecting the fight against mass incarceration, that those are the ways in which we can concretely, not just intellectually, but materially support the liberation of all people.
Professor Robin Spencer, an organizer of the World Stands with Palestine rally, October 11th in Harlem. Today, in Syria and Iraq, the United States is bombing the same jihadist fighters that it gave money and weapons to, it seems like, only yesterday. In New York, activists with UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition, held a conference call to mobilize against the expanding war. They were addressed by Vijay Prashad, the professor of history and international studies. Dr. Prashad said too many people on the left mistakenly believe that they can use the hammer of imperial military power to do good in the world.
The question that we have to ask is, what has been the U.S. war aims, or what has been U.S. policy in that region for the last, say, 5 years or 10 years? So I think it's well worth questioning people. What has been American policy vis-a-vis Syria? I mean, once again, when it has been worthwhile, the United States has used Syrian institutions for its own ends. For instance, for extraordinary rendition. When it was useful, the U.S. government used the institutions that they are now saying are institutions of torture. The question I'm raising is, what has been Western policy, American policy, vis-a-vis Syria over the last 10 odd years? That's, I think, a very important thing. Because if we're going to say, why are they bombing in northern Syria? What is the end game? That was the term that is often used, and that was implied in the New York Times piece, in the editorial. What is the end game? Is the end game to simply smash the Islamic State group? Is the end game, as Mr. Obama said, to both hit the Islamic State and to remove the Assad regime? I mean, is the end game to create now, miraculously, after 3 years of failure, some kind of moderate force that's going to be able to do this work for the United States? You know, all this seems rather ridiculous. That's why I'm just saying that details are extremely important. There's no way to make the argument simply on the basis that the war is bad, because we are going to have to argue against an enormous amount of propaganda that says, well, what is your strategy against the Islamic State? What do you propose? And I think that needs to be answered. That cannot be ducked. There are actually very clear ways to deal with a group like the Islamic State. And in order to deal with it, you have to understand that, firstly, we have to be clear that imperialism is not something that can be, is not a hammer that can be used for the purposes of the left that some people were arguing in 2011. I think that was Gilbert Achcar's position, that sometimes you can pick up the imperialist hammer and use it for your own purposes. I think this is a good example of why that is not so. Right now, the United States government has been bombing inside Syria. What have they bombed? They bombed in Raqqa, where there are buildings that are of no value to the Islamic State fighters. You know, they're essentially abandoned. In Aleppo, they bombed Jabhat al-Nusra positions, not the Islamic State. And there, amazingly, they discovered a group. And this group is truly a group but they, you know, inflamed the danger of the Khorasan group. And, you know, the man who runs it, is there are millions of people like him. You know, you can take his bio or take another man's bio and you can say, ah, this is Mr. Al-Fadli, he's a dangerous man. There are many people like that that can be lifted out who maybe are plotting imminent attack. It sounds a little fishy to me. So the attack in Aleppo was fascinating because that was not against Islamic State. That was against the Nusra group, which means that if you're going to strike both the Nusra group and the Islamic State, and in fact, the Islamic State and Nusra have an internal contradiction, they are going to now come together. That means all the hardened Islamists are going to start uniting. The third place they struck was the oil fields, a couple of refineries in eastern Syria. You have to understand that the Islamic State is not a big corporation. They're not a big business. They've used the oil sales to raise revenue. But they are not motivated by basically a capitalist logic. They are not profit-seeking. They are not going to care if the refineries are closed off. They'll find other ways to raise revenue. They have other games in play. This is a very old-fashioned kind of 20th century version of war planning. You bomb their office in Raqqa, you bomb their refineries, and then, of course, they strike this small group that is supposed to be giving them the reason to go and bomb. What they didn't strike, and I think this comes to the point of why you can't use imperialism as a hammer, what they didn't strike was the ISIS siege on the city of Kobane, which is on the Turkish border. Why is this important? Firstly, from our perspective, my perspective as somebody of the left, the group that is defending the city of Kobane is a Marxist organization. They are the YPG, they are the PKK, the Kurdish Workers' Party. They are considered by the Turks and the Americans as terrorists. It's interesting that here is a siege with 500,000 people that if you believed that the Islamic State, and it's quite likely that they would have killed the Yazidis in northern Iraq, it was PKK fighters that went and broke the Islamic State siege against the Yazidis in northern Iraq. And when the United States arrived there, they found those fighters there. So it's this same group that is now under siege in Kobane. And the United States didn't bomb to relieve the siege. This should reveal something to us and to other people. The U.S. is bombing not necessarily to push forward the good side of history. It doesn't do that. You cannot lift the hammer of imperialism to suit your purposes. It simply doesn't hit the nails that you want it to hit. Gilbert Achkar was wrong in 2011, and that position is wrong today. So it's not effective for humanity in any case. What is going to be able to fight against the Islamic State? The Kurdish groups are doing it, and a major American ally is not making it easy for them to do it, and that's Turkey. You will notice that the Obama administration has said nothing about Turkey. So there is going to be no attempt to close Turkey's forward policy of engaging with the Islamic State. A Kurdish official told me very clearly that the Islamic State for Turkey is like the Taliban was for Pakistan, or is for Pakistan. A very useful kind of, you know, deniable organization that creates problems in a neighboring country and allows you then to, you know, basically fulfill your land grabs. I mean, Turkey has ambitions to come and take part of Kobane because there's an important shrine there. The founder of the Ottoman Empire is buried near there. So there are all kinds of territorial claims that Turkey will make, etc. So what I'm just trying to say is that in terms of effectiveness, there are fighters. There are the Kurds. There are, you know, other groupings that would like to join, including, of course, the Syrian army. I think it's important not to fall back in the position of, you know, the enemy is your friend. I think much clearer is the fact that after 3 years, the Syrian government itself is a very different character than it was 3 years ago. And I think they have understood where their limitations are and what kind of political path forward needs to be created. So I think one of the big pressures now from an anti-war movement is to make the demand that if indeed this is a threat to the region, and I personally believe that this group is a threat to the region, then there needs to be a political settlement now in Syria to lift the complexity off the back of the Syrian army so it can enter to defend the cities against the onrush of the Islamic State. The anti-war movement, I think, has to put pressure to expose these ties with Turkey and to expose Turkey's complicity in the allowance of the Islamic State. Mr. Erdogan said that it's not the responsibility of Turkey to stop fighters going across the border. I mean, I personally have seen fighters stream across the border. He said it's not the responsibility of Turkey to stop them. It's the responsibility of sending countries, which is amazing because this is an admission that Turkey has been allowing fighters in from all over the world, you know, 15 to 20,000 people from other parts of the world. So the move has to be to expose the Obama administration's complicity with Turkey in allowing that border freedom. And the last thing I want to say is that all this kind of stuff opens the door to a lot of, I think, unnecessary discussions. Like, for instance, was the Islamic State created by the CIA in a camp in Jordan? I think that all of that may be true, may not be true, but it's unnecessary. You know, the fact is that I don't believe that the CIA created the Islamic State. It was created as part of the detritus of the Iraq War, when various forces took advantage of the chaos to enter northern Iraq. You know, it's a different history. So I think the issue isn't that there was a mysterious plot. It's perfectly transparent that the Gulf Arab states, that Turkey and others have been fostering these elements. This is a direct repeat of the story of Afghanistan. They've been fostering these elements. These elements are getting a little further against the leash than they would like, and that is definitely scaring them. In other words, there's no need for our analysis to go beyond what the evidence is suggesting. The evidence is very clear. There is a complicity here. That complicity needs to be exposed, and that very complicity is what's preventing the real struggle against the Islamic State, which is, I think, bringing the Kurds some relief, and on the other side, having a political settlement in Syria so that the Syrian army and others can take the fight directly to the Islamic State.
Dr. Vijay Prashad, Professor of History and International Studies at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. Historian, activist, and author Paul Street is noted for his early insights into Barack Obama's alliances with Wall Street and the Pentagon. Street watched in disgust as President Obama spoke to the United Nations last week, attempting to justify U.S. policy in the Middle East.
Well, he was flashing those angry eyes he's so famous for. I remember that look from back in the day in Chicago at an event every once in a while. Obama would seem all kind of cool and professorial and smooth, but then he'd get that flash of anger there. And, of course, he's outraged at the inhumanity of ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. And he said that if you look at their barbarism, if you look at their brutality, he said that forces us to look into the heart of darkness. That's what he said, the heart of darkness, that ISIS is the heart of darkness. You know, which is an interesting choice of phrases because it comes from a novel that many scholars have found significantly racist to some degree by Joseph Conrad, right? The novel about a supposedly civilized white traders, trip down the Congo River in the supposedly barbarian Central Africa novel back in late 19th century. And I was listening to Obama. The hypocrisy, right? I mean, you want to talk about darkness. The other thing he said was that the only thing these killers listen to is the language of force. Well, I was thinking, you want to talk about the heart of darkness. You want to talk about the language of force. How about Israel recurrently massacring hundreds of Palestinian children in Gaza in U.S. planes and U.S. helicopters with U.S. weapons and ordnance? Israel calls it mowing the lawn. You know, does that make us look into the heart of darkness? How about there's one of many scenes in Jeremy Scahill's book, Dirty Wars, where a military informant confidentially tells Scahill that when Obama orders he personally targets the terrorists that he wants to kill, and they want to get one guy, and they've got a house that's got 35 people in it. Well, everybody in that house is going to die just to get that one guy. You know, is that the heart of darkness? Is that that language of force? How about when Saudi Arabia, who's now our new supposedly democratic partner, right? It's the most reactionary state on earth. And they regularly practice execution through beheading. And then there's this 22 last month. There were 15 beheadings the month before. But I mean, something could go on. I mean, you know, we killed 500,000 Iraqis in the 1990s. 500,000 children, Iraqi children, through economic sanctions, right? And when Madeleine Albright, Bill Clinton's Secretary of State, who's a friend of Obama's, was asked about it on TV. She said, well, we think the price is worth it, right? We think that gigantic death toll of children is worth it. So, I mean, you could go on and on about Heart of Darkness, and I won't, because it's just, Obama talked about this network of death that ISIS has set up around the world. Well, you want to talk about a network of death, you know, look at a map of U.S. military bases and forces in the Middle East and around the world. The U.S. maintains more than, 1,000 military installations across more than 100 sovereign nations. You know, is that a network of death? Well, that network generated, by some estimates, 3.3 million deaths in Iraq since 1990, since Operation Desert Storm. But there's that chutzpah of talking about these people as if ISIS, as if they have some sort of monopoly on brutality, when in fact, you know, the number of people they killed is a drop in the bucket compared to the river of blood produced by the United States. But, you know, then he got up there. Oh, I love this, how I all of a sudden identified this group that nobody ever heard of before called the Khorasan Group. And they supposedly are headquartered in Syria, and they supposedly are working on bombs that pose an imminent threat to the people of the United States, even though no one's ever heard of. What's that all about? Well, of course, he invented that. They brought that in at the last moment because they need to have some sort of international legal sanction for carrying out basically an unprovoked attack in foreign territory. In Syria, then he denounced Moscow. He said he told Russia that they're going to pay a price for bullying the Ukraine, and he denounced Moscow, you know, for holding a view of the world where might makes right. And the jaw just drops, you know, and the eyes just roll. I mean, my God, you want to talk about a country that thinks that might makes right. Look at the United States with its 1,000 military bases around the world and U.S. special forces deployed right now in 134 countries, you know, and meanwhile, the U.S., the West, and particularly the U.S., provoked the whole Ukraine crisis there, the main driving force behind it. I won't go into the specifics of exactly how, because it's detailed, but it's, you know, NATO expansion is a key phrase there. And then Obama went on to sort of suggest that the United States is the leading force in the world trying to solve climate change, even though it's the leading force that's been undermining any and all efforts at binding global carbon emission reductions for two decades, and with particular intensity under Obama, who's just almost singly undermined the carbon emissions treaty in Copenhagen in 2009, and who has also green-lighted and launched massive offshore oil drilling and fracking, all ecologically disastrous, in the name of so-called national energy independence. So, you know, it's just mind-boggling.
And literally none of this carnage in Syria would be happening if it were not for the United States and its European and Arab and Turkish allies funneling billions of dollars to jihadists like ISIS.
Well, you know, I mean, I think that's absolutely right. And, of course, the pathetic thing about that, of course, we live in the United States of amnesia, where all U.S. imperial crimes go instantly down George Orwell's memory hole. But that's just a repeat of the U.S. funding and sponsorship and deployment in the late Cold War era of al-Qaeda. Einstein's definition of insanity is just doing the same thing over and over again and thinking it will work when it never worked before. You know, another thing that's being repeated, too, is all this mystery and the official propaganda coming out of Washington and just been sort of repeated loyally by the dominant media. This official mystery about why they hate us, you know, in the Middle East. It's like it's just, we're supposed to all just be completely clueless. We have no idea. It's really just because they're pre-modern, middle, evil, backwards-looking, uncivilized barbarians. And, of course, they hate freedom because we have, supposedly we have so much freedom and we have so much democracy, but that's a joke right there. But they hate our freedom. They hate our democracy. They hate our supposed great gender equity. That's what they said after 9/11. That's the story on ISIS. It has nothing to do with reality. They do not hate us because of who we are. Well, I really should say who we think we are. They hate us because of what we do. And you don't have to be a leftist or a radical or a Noam Chomsky reader or a Marxist anti-imperialist. This was what that guy, he used to be known as Anonymous. And then we found out his name was Michael Schur. And all he was in the late 20th century and in the early 21st century was the top CIA, al-Qaeda, and bin Laden analyst. And he wrote one or two books just trying to break through this narrative that they hate us because of who we are and trying to point out to them on the basis of his thorough and comprehensive analysis of Al-Qaeda communications. It's really about what we do. They're concerned about their region. They want us the hell out of there, and they want to topple these terrible regimes that we support.
What is undisputable is that they hate the idea of U.S. militaries on their soil, which may be why the United States is forced to go into proxy war mode.
Yeah, they hate U.S. military on the soil of Muslim lands. They know very well that the U.S. military is concentrated in around the Persian Gulf region for one reason, and one reason only, and that is the incredible super strategic concentration of fossil fuel resources in the region. They resent decades of Western extraction of their vital raw materials, an extraction, by the way, that we now know is destroying, along with homeland fracking and homeland drilling, is destroying a livable ecology. And they also hate U.S. sponsorship of despotic, brutal, aristocratic regimes over there, like the House of Saud and the people who run the United Arab Emirates, and those sultans and those princes and those emirs. And, you know, we've been backing them for decades because they give us access to oil. I mean, it's as simple as that, you know. So they don't like the proxies. I think that the U.S. is sort of being forced to come in directly. And there's these little footnotes associated with this escalation that, in fact, troops on the ground are a very real possibility, precisely because ISIS is capturing this mass resentment against these regimes and is really threatening to bring them down. And when those regimes come down, Washington has very good reasons to fear. So does our access, our privileged access to and control of Middle Eastern oil.
Yes, the real imminent threat that ISIS and other jihadists present in that region of the world is actually to Qatar and Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates and Jordan and all those other monarchies.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And it's doctrinally unacceptable in U.S. media to talk about something that's been very candidly discussed within planning documents among U.S. global strategists for decades, really coming out of World War II, so that this region matters to us. And we have to have political influence in this region and, where necessary, military influence. We have to overthrow governments if necessary, which we've done repeatedly over there, because of the financial resources. I mean, that's just what you can't really admit. It would be acknowledging that we're an imperial power and that we essentially inherited that role from the British after World War II. So it has to be wrapped into this rhetoric of civilization versus barbarism and these supposed threats to us, ourselves, which is just preposterous. And all this emphasis on foreign fighters that are supposedly going to train over there and come back here, and it's right out of Orwell.
At what point do you think the United States will turn its military might directly against the Syrian government, or do you think they'll do that?
I think they're a little skittish about doing that because of what that would mean globally with regard to Russia. Smart planners have done great danger to human prospects in many ways, but one of them is just this pricking again of Russia. And that would be true audacity, and that would be true recklessness. If they're going to do that, then they're ready to set the world aflame, in my opinion, along with these incredibly provocative actions in the Ukraine and in Eastern Europe, this sending of special forces and advisors into former Soviet republics, the placement of gunships and missile-carrying ships in the Black Sea, right in the underbelly of Russia, and then attacking directly the regime of a strong Russian ally, which is also an ally of Iran, which is sort of the unmentionable real enemy of U.S. policy in the Middle East anyway. That would be a hell of a thing for them to undertake, and I would hope that millions of us would hit the streets and bring this imperial system down.
But you did say he had fire in his eyes.
Yes. Well, you know, Obama scares me a little bit, and I've always sort of jokingly said to friends over the years that he can never really fully match his mentor, the arch militarist JFK, until he brings the world to the brink of a thermonuclear disaster, right? And, you know, the really sick part of the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was driven mainly by JFK and mainly by the White House, did not need to be handled anything like the way they handled it, and which came within literally seconds of global annihilation. Of course, you know, the damn shame of it is if he really wanted to rescue anything for his legacy, would be to shut this imperial thing down, apologize to the people in the Middle East, dedicate money to reparations for all the millions we've killed over there, apologize for our empire, and initiate and call for a massive campaign against poverty, against inequality, against racism in the United States, and start calling for massive green jobs programs to try and save livable ecology, which may be beyond all hope now in the next 5 years. You know, something like that. But no, that's not going to happen. We're not going to have any turn left. We're going to have this sort of remainder of his power-serving term is going to be sort of dedicated to this kind of twilight war against Islamist extremism, and we're going to call them extremists. Like I said, it's right out of Orwell.
Paul Street is author of the book, The Empire's New Clothes, Barack Obama and the Real World of Power. Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, sees the United States as the architect of destruction in the world. He filed this report for Prison Radio.
It is fascinating to watch U.S. presidents as they call names and promise destruction, especially so soon after the flood of disasters that have been waged throughout the Middle East. Iraq is a social, economic, environmental, and spiritual basket case. Libya is little better. Both are horrific examples of U.S. interventions that have plunged both societies into deadly hellscapes, places of religious strife, kidnappings, broken institutions, and rape. For the U.S. and its so-called allies are good at destruction of governments. Reconstruction? Not so much. Now the American way lumbers into Syria, ostensibly to weaken ISIS, lately called the Islamic State. As in Iraq and later Libya, the U.S. and its ignoble allies are in contempt of the people who are invariably referred to coldly as collateral damage. The Arab so-called allies cover for the imperialists who are actually collaborators with Western foreigners. All the rap about training armies? If the U.S. couldn't do it in 12 years, a few months are simply laughable. This means that the U.S. and Western military efforts will continue indefinitely, for months, for years, perhaps. And to what end? Democracy? An end to terrorism? Hardly. For one thing, imagine the various and sundry members of the so-called coalition. Should it surprise us that, with the exception of France, there's hardly a democracy among them? This war, like the Iraq War before it, promised heaven but delivered hell. It was and is a disaster that promises more suffering for the Arabs, who had the immense misfortune of being born in lands where lakes of oil bubbled beneath them.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, speaking from Frackville State Prison in Pennsylvania. In Atlanta, Georgia last week, the Rwandan government staged a giant public relations event called Rwanda Day in praise of the country's warlord and dictator Paul Kagame. Protesters also gathered, including Black Agenda Report managing editor Bruce Dixon, who said Rwanda Day is based on lies, that Paul Kagame and his military did not stop the genocide in 1994, but in fact began the killing, and then went on to snuff out the lives of at least 6 million people in the Congo.
Somebody needs to explain to folks what's going on when you've got a thing here from the government of Rwanda. And why should we be suspicious when the Black Caucus or the mayor opens his doors and invites African dignitaries in and with supposedly representatives of the do-gooder organizations here in the United States there at the same table? What's really happening here? Is it sweetness and light and acknowledgement of our African heritage? Is that what's going on? Or is there something sinister going on? And how do we explain that? So this has been an interesting series of lessons, and I'm going to try to address some of that in the piece that I'm doing. What are the ties here between our Black political class and the representatives of African states who are here? And what do those ties mean? In this case, African governments have a few million ripped from the hide of their suffering people to spend in PR, you know? And black political class wants a cut of that. They want to do that. And then, of course, you've got the examples of people like Jindai Frazier and Susan Rice and that whole core. And I've never heard Susan Rice speak to black people. But I do know that some of the people in academia who are here at Georgia State University in Emory, they'll go around and mumble words about Pan-Africanism while they try to get a contract with the DRC government or the Kenyan or Ugandan or Rwandan government. And they'll turn around the black Americans and the Africans and mumble some about Pan-Africanism and to go to the motherland and how they're serving all this kind of bullshit.
They're trying to get PR contracts.
Yeah, they're trying to get PR contracts.
What about the need to put black faces on corporate resource interests in Africa?
These are multinational companies here that are doing business. When the affirmative action thing was up before Congress, and Republicans were marshaling their forces against it, and then what happened was Pentagon came forward and lots of Fortune 500 corporations came forward. And the Pentagon says, wait, we need high-ranking, well-educated, accomplished blacks and Latinos to front for what we're doing here, for our long-term plans. We can't be an all-white military and carry on what we got to carry on in Africa. And the company said, wait, there's emerging markets here that we want to control, and African and Latin American and Asian governments that we got to deal with. We can't look like we're all white. We can't do that. We got to have black faces. And it's important to our long-term survival and viability. This is an empire, you know? This is an empire. And the empire needs black faces representing it.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the black left. And while you're there, make plans to attend Black Agenda Report's 8th year anniversary celebration at historic Riverside Church in New York City on October 24th. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.